Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. I'm your host, Mono. Happy New Year, or Akemashite Omedetou in Japanese. In Japan, we don't get a real Christmas holiday, but instead a lengthy New Year one. There's a lot of customs surrounding the New Year holiday. You've got to eat soba, you've got to watch kohaku, you've got to visit a shrine, and of course, you've got to shop. Tokyo has a great atmosphere around the New Year's, if you don't mind the cold. It's finally 2022. We are burning through these years, aren't we? 2020 was rough for everyone, but I had a great 2021, and 2022 looks even better. Everyone's hoping that international travel will open up, and it could be likely. Though I did think everyone could freely travel in 2021, and turned out I was wrong. But I'm pulling for 2022. Hopefully everyone around the world can visit Tokyo sooner than later. And of course, you should all be using this podcast to help plan out your trip, at least the gaming portion of it. If this is your first episode, be sure to check out the past ones where I highlight cool places to visit in Tokyo. Last time was a special Game of the Year themed episode, and this episode is a bit special too. I'll be focusing on previewing Nintendo Switch games coming in 2022, or at least they say they're coming out in 2022. I can't make any promises. This year looks absolutely insane for Nintendo. Not only are there new entries in major first-party franchises like Splatoon and Zelda, but also a lot of notable third-party support and, of course, those wonderful indies. 2022 could be a monumental one in gaming, as many games that were delayed due to COVID are likely hitting this year. For Nintendo, we could have a repeat of 2017, where they had month after month of major game-changing releases. I will mostly be focusing on games already announced, but I'll certainly throw in a bit of speculation too. Nintendo surely hasn't announced everything coming out, and they like to keep their big holiday games under wrap until about E3. I'll be throwing out my guesses for some unannounced titles that I think are likely, and hey, I might as well toss in some games that maybe don't have a chance, but I would still like to see them on the Switch. After I wrap up the previews, I'll get into some recent news. And yes, there is still a feature this week. This episode's feature highlights Pokemon Wonder, a nature adventure where you explore and find quote-unquote real Pokemon. It's a new attraction at Yomiuri Land, a popular theme park in Tokyo. It's definitely the most active and unique thing I've highlighted thus far, so you won't want to miss it. Let's get started. Could it be Nintendo's biggest year yet? The Switch shows no sign of stopping, and Nintendo isn't content with just coasting. If the Switch is nearing the end of its life, it's going out with a bang and not a whimper. Instead of gaming impressions for this episode, I want to focus on digging through the Switch's upcoming catalog and talk about what I find exciting, and maybe a bit of theory crafting as well. I'll be touching on games both big and small, but I can't promise I'll hit everything. A lot of games don't have hard dates yet, but I will try to go in chronological order. The first big game of the year is Pokemon Legends Arceus, which will hit on January 28th. This is the latest Pokemon title from Game Freak, but instead of Gen 9, it is a completely different game. It's an action RPG in an open-ish world. Game Freak has said it's not an open-world game, but it's clearly presented as a very Breath of the Wild-inspired title. I believe it will have not one continuous world, but instead open zones that you can explore. Monster Hunter Stories 2 functions in the same way, with each chapter taking you to another part of the world with one huge open area to explore and smaller, more linear segmented areas. I know some people are disappointed by this, instead preferring one continuous open world, but Monster Hunter Stories proved to me that this structure can work. One element they seem to be borrowing from the main Monster Hunter title is that you have one central hub instead of multiple cities or towns. This is kind of a bummer to me since I love the flow of exploring routes and caves in Pokemon and then refreshing in a town. The towns in Pokemon are pretty unique. I finished up BDSP recently and, at least in Sinnoh, every settlement has its own theme and unique activities to do there. So to shove everything into one area is a bit disappointing in my mind. Also, how amazing was it in Breath of the Wild to suddenly come across a town or settlement after getting lost for hours? They recently revealed the Ginkgo Guild, which is a group of traveling merchants, and the Diamond and Pearl clans. I wonder if they will maybe have little encampments out in the field where you can recharge, similar to the horse stables in Breath of the Wild. The combat changes do seem quite exciting. Pokemon's battle system has pretty much had the same structure since the Game Boy. Yes, they've added a lot of things going on under the hood, like abilities and double battles, but it's always been a turn-based battle system where you pick one attack out of four. They seem to be keeping that in some respects, but there is a turn order and even stances that alter your attack. Personally, I do love the Pokemon battle system as it is. It's very simplistic, but also incredibly strategic in competitive battles. And part of the reason why Pokemon is so popular is that anyone can understand its battle system and play. But hey, this is a spin-off, so it's the perfect place to mix it up. I also think it's cool in Arceus how Pokemon can attack you in the field. You don't seem to have as many traversal options as Breath of the Wild, but having the more dynamic elements and the ability to crouch and dodge definitely give the game a different feel. I'm curious to see how hard they lean into these aspects. Let me fight a Pokemon with my bare hands. I can take down at least a few of them. I am incredibly curious about this game, and I feel there are still many things yet to be revealed. I'm glad Game Freak is being ambitious with this title, and I am excited to see the future of Pokemon. I know it's probably not good podcast etiquette to talk about the next episode 10 minutes into this one, but I want to do a deep dive preview on Pokemon Legends Arceus next episode, so I am holding my tongue on a lot of things here. Arceus is the biggest game in January, but there are still quite a few other noteworthy titles. Astroneer is finally coming to Switch. It's a popular procedurally generated crafting and resource gathering game. You know, one of those. It's a huge hit on PC, so I can see the Switch version being big right out of the gate. It could join the elite company of Among Us and Stardew Valley, as those titles are always in the Switch eShop rankings. Another big indie title is Windjammers 2 from .emu. This was announced all the way back in 2018, but it's finally here. It's the sequel to the 1994 classic combat frisbee game? Or is it like a bigger version of Pong or air hockey or frisbee volleyball? If you've never played it, it's a 1v1 game where you try to throw a frisbee into the other person's goal. You can do special moves and bounce the frisbee off walls. It can get very intense, and there's actually quite a bit of strategy involved. The first Windjammers is on Switch and still holds up today, so we'll see if Windjammers 2 is more iterative or completely changes how you play. The next two games are a bit odd in terms of their release, but both Vivid Knight and Record of Lodoss War, Deedlit and Wonder Labyrinth are available in Japan now, but come to the States in January. I talked a bit about Vivid Knight last week. It's a roguelike deck builder with cute anime characters. Wonder Labyrinth is a Metroidvania that is very inspired by Symphony of the Night. I love the Lodoss War anime back in the day, so I'm pretty interested in this game. However, I do wonder if I would care about the game if it didn't star Deedlit. I'm grouping these two games together because even though they are only available in Japan right now, they actually have English options. So I'm not sure why they aren't in the West yet, unless they are worried it will get buried by other holiday titles. Well, that was just January. February does seem much lighter in comparison. Although this game was originally announced for February, it was delayed to summer. But Dragon Quest X Offline Edition is coming to Japan. They've basically taken the story of Dragon Quest X, the online game, and turned it into a more traditional Dragon Quest title. DQ10 never came out overseas, and some people have been predicting that maybe the offline version does come out. Not impossible, but I wouldn't hold my breath. Some February titles that are coming out are the 2D skateboarder Ollie Ollie World and the cloud version of Dying Light 2. The first Dying Light came to the Switch last October, and most people said it was a pretty faithful port. Cloud versions are a good idea in theory, but I don't feel like the Switch audience has really responded to them. I have no idea if they actually sell well because I never see them on the eShop rankings, but it's better than nothing, I suppose. March. Two words for you. Triangle strategy. In that order. I have been begging for Final Fantasy Tactics on Switch. Every year I'm ignored, but Square did throw me a bone with this FFT-esque title from the Octopath and Bravely Default team led by Asano. I played the demo and yeah, this isn't my type of game. They seem to improve on a lot of things since that demo, including implementing a much cleaner visual style. The demo had this weird purple grid on top that made it very difficult to see your range. But now they were just going with the traditional blue and red grid. Don't fix what's not broken. It doesn't seem like you create party members or choose classes, so it's closer to Fire Emblem than FFT on that front. I do like making my own characters and naming them silly things, but I have no qualms with moving established characters around on a grid. Hopefully the game still allows for a lot of customization in terms of character growth and abilities. In the demo, one character had a spy class with a lot of fun abilities like turning invisible, so I want more interesting techniques like that present in the main game. The main gimmick they seem to be pushing is the Scales of Conviction, where you make choices that could heavily affect the story. There are three routes, I suppose. Morality, liberty, and utility, my three favorite things. The story is about a war between three countries trying to wrestle control of the resources salt and iron, so I wonder if each concept applies to one country, like the morality country, the liberty country, and so on. In Three Houses, you picked your team and you went along with the ride, but maybe Triangle Strategy wants it to be more granular. Or maybe these choices are just very surface level, like the result is just different dialogue or something very insignificant changes during the battle. Even if the choice system is very shallow, I can see myself loving this game if the combat is excellent. One thing that has me excited about the combat is that you can affect the field somewhat. For example, you can burn down wooden houses or use a lightning attack on water. It definitely reminds me of how the elements interacted with each other in Breath of the Wild. I wonder if it will have that level of interactivity and openness in the puzzle aspects. Oh, and it will utilize the HD 2D look that Octopath also has. I really love this aesthetic. I think it is the perfect way to display 16-bit graphics in a more modern setting without losing the tone and appeal of those graphics. Every little thing about Triangle Strategy has me excited, so I can't wait for March 4th. Square Enix is also pushing out Chocobo GP a week later. It's a kart racer and a sequel to 1999's Chocobo Racing. I'm always up for kart racers, and there are definitely enough fun Final Fantasy elements to pull from. The tracks run through classic areas like the Golden Saucer, and all the racers are famous FF characters like Chocobos, Moogles, White Mage, Vivi, and so on. Each character also has its own unique abilities. I mean, they gotta put Sephiroth in this thing, right? I'm looking at the roster of Chocobo Racing, and both Cloud and Squall are in it. Not only that, Aya Bray from Parasite Eve is also a character, and Jack from the 3D Battles of World Runner, a game released the same year as Final Fantasy from Square. I'm sure there is a universe where Final Fantasy bombed and World Runner is Square's most important franchise. So maybe there might be some obscure characters that pop up in this thing. I'm hoping for anyone from Dungeon Encounters. Although a date hasn't been announced, Square also previously announced a HD 2D version of Dragon Quest III. I don't know what else to say except it really looks beautiful. I think this is the perfect way to translate old games into a new art style. I'm really looking forward to this one, and hopefully they might add a few new classes too. Wait, what's this? It says here that Persona 4 is coming to Switch? After all these years, I can't believe we are finally getting Persona 4 on Nintendo's... Oh, it's Persona 4 Arena Ultimax, that fighting game. It came out on PS3 and 360 in 2014. Not exactly the number one requested Atlas game for Nintendo fans, but it's something. I'm sure there's someone out there who loves both Ultimax and Persona 5 Scramble, and is just in heaven right now. Rune Factory 5 also hit Switch on March 22nd. It came out in Japan last year, so people who want to play it in English have been waiting quite a while. I'm sorry, I know very little about Rune Factory. It's a series like Atelier, which has been going on for a long time, and people love it, but I just never got around to it. Switch has quite a lot of farming and lifestyle simulation games, so really, just live inside your Switch. There's no need to do anything else. Speaking of games I know little about, Shinigami Shibito Magire from Experience also comes out in late March. It's the third game in a series that started with Spirit Hunter Deathmark and Spirit Hunter NG. It's a creepy horror visual novel adventure game. Should I try these out? I typically don't like horror games, but if it's framed as more like a visual novel and not something that has, you know, things jumping out at you, it might be fun. I often see Deathmark on sale and it has a striking icon, so it's stuck in my head. Sadly, it's Japan only for now, but the first two games came out in the West, so I think it's only a matter of time. We're out of March. Let's truck on to April. 13 Sentinels Aegis Rim is coming to Switch on April 12th. This is a mind-bending visual novel slash tower defense game from Atlas. And yes, it's the actual game and not some fighting game spinoff. 13 Sentinels was on a lot of people's top 10 lists in 2020, so it's worth keeping an eye on. A lot of people also really got into the yakisoba pan, which is a sandwich filled with noodles. This is something I have never seen in Japan, sorry to say, but it doesn't mean it's not out here somewhere. Also, please get hyped for Tokenranmu Warriors, a Musou game starring the Otome heroes. This is the second time I brought up Tokenranmu on this podcast, and I'm guessing it won't be the last. And that's it for games with hard dates. The rest might have some vague date, like spring, but otherwise, it's up in the air. Some of these could slip to 2023. I don't want them to, I don't think they will, but it is a possibility. I just want to throw that out there. But you should be like me and believe. Believe that these are all 2022 games. One game that got delayed into 2022 is Advance Wars 1+2 Reboot Camp. This is a remake of the first two Advance War games on the GBA developed by Intelligent Systems. This time, WayForward is taking over development duties. It suddenly showed up on last year's E3, had a December release date, but was delayed out of nowhere. It's always a shame when a game gets delayed, but Nintendo typically doesn't do it unless there's a good reason. So I have high expectations for this game when they show it off again. I would be satisfied if they just had all the content from the first two games, including the War Room missions and online multiplayer. But I wouldn't turn down something new. I think creating maps and sharing them online would be a lot of fun. The last Advance Wars game was 2008, so there's been a whole generation of Nintendo fans who have never touched the series. And even the last game, Days of Ruin, was ignored by many. I admittedly only owned the first one and played a bit of Dual Strike. I'm not a hardcore fan, but there is room for it in today's gaming landscape. And that first game is really solid. I wouldn't mind revisiting it at all. Some people were upset with the graphics, but they've certainly had time to polish it up. I'm not quite sure the ideal design for this game. You could go for a more toy aesthetic and make everything look plasticky, or kind of give it a bit of chibi realism where the vehicles are still these monochromatic blocky things, but with more realistic details like scratches and dents. I didn't think it looked bad at E3, though. I know a lot of people lament the shift from pixels to 3D graphics because the animations of those GBA games were excellent, but what are you going to do? No date for now, but spring isn't out of the question. Oh, and this is the perfect time to talk about the bizarre history of Advance Wars in Japan. The games were developed by Intelligent Systems, a Japanese company, but Advance Wars on GBA never came out in Japan. Keep in mind that Advance Wars itself is a continuation or spiritual successor to the War series that was Japan only. You had Famicom Wars, Super Famicom Wars, Game Boy Wars, etc. So a Japan-only series got a West-only release. It did eventually come out in Japan bundled with the second game on GBA, titled Game Boy Wars Advance 1+2. So ironically, the remake is sort of taking the title from a Japan-only bundle. Advance Wars Dual Strike came out in Japan as Famicom Wars DS. They went back to the Famicom Wars name, despite the fact that no handheld game had that title. Oh, and Days of Ruin? It never came out in Japan, until it was released as a Club Nintendo bonus for Japanese 3DS owners as Famicom Wars Lost Light in 2015. On top of that, this remake for Switch never announced for Japan. I think Nintendo could pull a reverse Famicom Detective Club, a remake that was Japan only, then delayed, then released worldwide. So I'm hoping the same thing happened here with Japan getting the game. Just call it Advance Wars, let's pull that bandaid off. One game that is definitely coming out in spring is Kirby and the Forgotten Land from HAL Laboratory. This is the first ever 3D Kirby platformer, and it's about time. HAL has said in the past that they wanted to do a more ambitious Kirby game after Star Allies, and here it is. Kirby is a wonderful series, but they often play it safe. Well, there are two types of Kirby games, safe yet enjoyable 2D platformers, and completely off-the-wall spin-offs. Now we have the most ambitious Kirby game yet. A fully 3D world for Kirby to explore and float around in. Outside of that, you are doing typical Kirby things like inhaling enemies and using their powers. We actually haven't seen a whole lot of the game, and many things are a mystery. I am curious to see if they implement any co-op or multiplayer in the main game. Setting it in a sort of post-apocalyptic landscape is certainly a bold choice. When Nintendo showed off the first trailer, I thought, is this a cute The Last of Us? And maybe it is. I'm sure there are many different locales that look unique, but the overgrown city is a fun look. Kirby Planet Robobot also sort of played with the idea of nature and technology intermingling, and there were a lot of visually striking levels and fun settings. Hopefully this game is the same with the diversity of its environments. Alright, a bit of gameplay speculation. Typically Kirby's flow is nigh infinite, but the levels are fairly compact so you can't just fly across the entire thing like in Super Mario World. But in a 3D space, well, you've got a lot of sky to navigate. I'm thinking the float would definitely be nerfed, or maybe have a set time or stamina bar-like system. Kirby games are typically pretty short. Most can be completed in about 5 to 10 hours, so I'm wondering if HAL will want to keep that same pacing, or maybe the open areas will add on to the playtime. And they really haven't said whether it's open world or not, though I doubt it's open world. If it was, I think they would be advertising it more. I'm thinking the levels are 3D, but still fairly linear, though there may be some more open areas like in Odyssey. Star Allies sold very well, and this one has a chance to connect with people who don't normally pay attention to Kirby, so this could be the most successful Kirby game yet. March, April? March isn't impossible. Gotta get in that fiscal year. Let's just keep going with these heavy hitters. Splatoon 3. This was the mic drop in the February 2021 Direct, and we've been getting a trickle of info since then. I expected a spinoff of the franchise eventually, but not this. I'm surprised Nintendo decided to release another Splatoon game on the Switch. The user base is active, I mean you can still get into a Splatoon 2 match right now with no issue. Splatoon 2 was there to guide people to the Switch, and now Splatoon 3 seems like it's going to cash in on the console's massive install base. I don't think it's out of the question that this game will have the best opening week on the Switch in Japan. Yes, even beating Animal Crossing. I feel like the hype is a bit tepid right now. I mean, they announced it nearly a year ago and we have no date, but once the marketing ramps up, it's going to be Splatoon mania all over again, especially in Japan. The franchise is hugely popular here. I came to Japan right around Splatoon 2's launch, and it felt like wherever I went, I saw ads for it and people wearing Splatoon merch. Tower Records had a huge Splatoon collaboration where they decked out the entrance with Splatoon imagery. I think Nintendo is going to go just as hard with Splatoon 3. Splatoon 2 felt like a continuation of the first game in many respects, especially in the aesthetics, but they are mixing it up a bit more here. Instead of high-tech urban landscapes, we're in a very deserty, almost apocalyptic-looking area. An obvious inspiration for Splatsville, the new hub, is the walled city of Kowloon. Shibuya this ain't. I think going so far in the opposite direction in terms of aesthetic is pretty daring. Splatoon has such a distinct look, so you would think it would just be iterations on that. But Nintendo is trying something very different here. Yeah, we still have a dose of street art, hip-hop, and other inspirations that this series is known for, but now we can add Mad Max to the pile. I'm sure they will have a lot of great ideas for the new setting and art direction. They've been showing off a lot of brown levels, so I hope it's not just that. The very grimy industrial look from what we've seen thus far almost reminds me of Team Fortress 2. That game does a great job of taking very boring things and making them stand out visually due to a coherent and clean art style. The single-player mode is called Return of the Mammalians, which is about mammals returning to the world of Splatoon. I honestly never noticed that Judd and Little Judd were the only two mammals we ever saw. I always thought Mr. Grizz was an actual bear. I mean, that was the joke, right? That we were collecting salmon eggs for him to eat? Because bears eat salmon? I've had people tell me that no, Mr. Grizz is not a bear at all, and I guess they're right. Like the other two story modes, it seems like you will be in some sort of weird void where you navigate by solving puzzles and fighting. The story modes in both Splatoon games are really excellent. They are only a few hours, and they are always introducing new gameplay mechanics or really fun ideas. A lot of people prefer the first game single-player mode, but I think the second game story mode was better overall. Yes, the first game has a much better final boss, but as a whole, the second game was phenomenally diverse in its levels and was quite challenging as well. These superb Octo stages have me even more excited for what they can do in the next single-player adventure. You also seem to have a little salmon buddy. They haven't quite explained why, but it's with you at the start of the game. Is it just for single-player, multiplayer, both? Will it have any real function or just be a pet? I think it would be neat if they integrated it into the multiplayer bit. Like have it be your support weapon or some sort of new attack. Maybe it could give you passive buffs like a mag in PSO. Though that might be a bit difficult to balance. I love how in Splatoon they redeem the villains somewhat. The Octolings were living with the squids in Splatoon 2, and now we're friends with the salmon. Though to be fair, the salmon really didn't seem overly hostile. Yeah, they attacked outposts, but that stuff was encroaching on their territory. Also, we were harvesting their eggs. Are we the baddies? I do wonder if Salmon Rush will return, though. I love Salmon Rush. I typically don't like horde modes at all because they're quite long, and often one little mistake can cause everything to come crashing down. But Salmon Run? It's quick, it's exciting, you're always doing something, and you get cool exclusive rewards. If you fail, oh well, you still get some points towards that reward. From the trailers, we can immediately see some new additions. One that sticks out for me is the bow. This is going to be an either incredibly fun or an incredibly annoying weapon. Again, another TF2 reference, the Huntsman, the famous bow for the sniper, which was both incredibly fun and incredibly annoying. There's also a crab mech, which looks like your special attack. I think it would be pretty interesting if they incorporated vehicles into the actual maps, though. Most Splatoon maps are pretty compact, and a big part of gameplay is remaining unseen. But you can't say that everyone walking around in mechs wouldn't be a blast. It's funny to look back now and remember that many assumed Splatoon 2 would be a port of the first game, or just Splatoon 1.5. Even though the two are very similar in many areas, Splatoon 2 still stands out with its new additions. Splatoon 3 looks like it's going to really go out of its way to separate itself from the past titles with its visual style, but I'm sure it will still have that core Splatoon gameplay that is still excellent. Release date? Well, they announced it in February of last year, so you could assume it would be early 2022, but the other two games came out in late spring and summer. So I think a summer release date is very likely. I mean, you don't want to play with Super Soakers in winter. How about another third game? Bayonetta 3. From Platinum Games, this is the next entry in the acclaimed action series. This was a major surprise announcement at the Game Awards. What year? Can you guess? 2017. It's been a while, right? Like Metroid Prime 4, it was one of those games Nintendo clearly announced way too early. Nintendo was typically very good about announcing and releasing games within a pretty short span, but we do occasionally have those outlier games like Bayo 3. Again, I'm sorry, I'm not a Bayonetta expert. They are on the Switch, but they really never go on sale. I'm sure many would argue that they are absolutely worth it at their current price, but there's a lot of games on Switch. I'll get to all of them eventually. The trailer opened up at the famous Shibuya Scramble. I honestly had no idea Bayonetta took place in our real world, and it makes me hope that she would tour other places in Tokyo. Lappy from Astral Chain also briefly appeared, but that was a huge swerve and Bayonetta jumped into battle. Combat seems to have some sort of focus on summoning huge kaiju-like monsters, but I'm sure the traditional combat styles will still be present. I've seen some people speculate that the character shown is not Bayonetta at all, but Sariza, who is a child in the other games. Some are speculating a Into the Spider-Verse type of story with multiple Bayonettas. She always has different hairstyles, so you could easily separate them that way. I don't know what else to say about this game except that I'm glad it's coming out and that people are excited. Maybe I should just jump in from Bayonetta 3. Or when it comes out, I would just invite a guest on so they can rave about the game. The release date is 2022 for now. Maybe October? It seems like a very Halloween-y type of game. Another game with no real release date yet is Mario + Rabbids Sparks of Hope, a strategy game from Ubisoft. This is the sequel to the first Mario + Rabbids game, which came out all the way back in 2017, the Switch's launch year. It was such a bizarre concept on paper, but a lot of people really engaged with it. I never completed it, but the concept was well thought out, and you could do a lot of fun and creative combos on the battlefield. I eventually fell off though because I felt like the battles were a bit slow and repetitive. I really like class customization in strategy games, and Mario + Rabbids doesn't really have that. I need levels. I need numbers. I'm willing to give this a shot though if they speed up the battles a bit. Ubisoft got rid of the grid and have talked about battles that can occur in the world, so those changes might be enough to keep it fresh. The overworld seems more open than it was in the past game, which were very linear outside a few paths that you could go down and maybe find some secret. Other new additions are Rabbid Rosalina. She has a long way to go if she wants to top Rabbid Peach, the greatest video game character of all time. There's also a Rabbid Luma. I'm trying to think of other galaxy-type rabbits we could have. Metal Spring Rabbids are an obvious inclusion, easily one of the most underrated Mario power-ups. The last game came out in August, so August 2022? There was actually a several-month delay for this game in Japan, so I doubt a worldwide release is happening this time around. I think it's time. Time to talk about that game. The game I want to talk about, the game you want me to talk about, the game that is on everybody's mind every second of the day. Even this second, right now. The sequel to The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Announced back in E3 2019, which seemed like an eternity ago, it's the, well, sequel to Breath of the Wild. It is a direct continuation, something the franchise hasn't done in quite a long time. Spirit Tracks took place 100 years after Phantom Hourglass, but features a whole new cast. Here we've got the same Link, the same Zelda, or do we? We have two trailers to go off of, the E3 2019 trailer and the E3 2021 trailer. Both are quite ambiguous in terms of story and gameplay mechanics, though we do get some major hints. The first trailer has Zelda and Link explore under Hyrule Castle, where they find a creepy glowing hand trying to clog up a creepy corpse who is spewing out creepy malice. Most seem to assume that the corpse is Ganon, due to the red hair and Gerudo symbols. However, the hand also seems very ominous. I mean, it looks like a freaky hand with long nails and weird armbands. You seem to get its power though, maybe it's just trying to help Link, or it was an accident, or is there an ulterior motive? Anyways, don't trust the hand. Link's new magic hand seems to replace the slate from the first game. It will likely function in the same way, except with new powers. The slate looks like the Switch, so does that mean the next piece of Nintendo hardware is a hand? The Nintendo hand? I mean, it's hard to predict what they would do next. One of the hand's new abilities is a time warp, where you can send items back to whence they came. The patent leak I talked about last episode also shows it off a bit. I can see this being a huge element of the puzzle solving, and some creative folks will likely use it in amazing ways in combat. The cool thing about the slate powers is that they were diverse and useful in and out of battle. I expect it will be the same here. I wonder if some old abilities will come back or if they will start from the ground up again and just give Link a completely new toolset. So, you've got a magic hand. The other major gameplay gimmick they seem to be pushing is the sky. Yes, everyone spent 2 years assuming you would be exploring under Hyrule, these labyrinthian caves and ruins, but nope, you're all up in the sky. The patent leaks from last episode also showed some combat mechanics revolving around falling, so going from the sky to the ground seems to be a big part of the gameplay flow. The reverse is true as well. The trailer shows Link warping up to a sky platform, and the patent leaks show that it seems to be a mechanic the player can control instead of just warp points. Seems like you can warp up, but do you have to dive back down? The sky concept, well, I guess we really don't know a lot about it, but it's certainly an unexpected one. I mean, we already did the sky, right? Skyward Sword? It's not exactly the same, but the concept of exploring these sky islands and diving to the surface are present in both games. Nintendo is in a difficult situation when it comes to following up Breath of the Wild. They spent years crafting perhaps the greatest open world in a video game, and to duplicate that on any level is a huge task. Nintendo has given talks regarding the design of Breath of the Wild, such as utilizing sightlines and the triangle rule in terms of how multiple points of interest are laid out. You could just make a completely new map with the same philosophy, and it could be excellent. But that takes a lot of time and money, and it's hard to get perfect. When it was announced in 2019, I think a lot of people assumed they would reuse the world and a lot of assets. The classic example is Majora's Mask. I think it's clear that Nintendo had a ton of ideas for Breath of the Wild that couldn't make it into the game, so why not make a second game with the same toolset? A Galaxy and Galaxy 2 situation. I feel like that would have been fine if the sequel came out in 2019 or maybe even 2020, but now it's coming out 5 years after the original game. It will almost be the same gap as from Skyward Sword to Breath of the Wild. Obviously, COVID threw a massive wrench into the development. What's a really big tool? A forklift? That got thrown in there. You want to give them the benefit of the doubt, but it's hard not to have expectations for this game. There have been a lot of fun theories thrown out about this game, like perhaps multiple Links, one in the past and one in the present. They never show his face during the gameplay portions in the trailer, so I do think there might be some merit to it as they show two different versions of Link, one in a blue tunic and one in the white and green robe with longer hair. A lot of people are also expecting Zelda to be playable. I mean, she has a more adventure-oriented haircut this time. Last we see of her, she is hurled into a bottomless pit, which doesn't look good for her chances, but you could do a dynamic where Link is above ground and Zelda is below. Though with all games that have swappable protagonists, it's hard to balance the pacing between the two. If the Zelda portions are frustrating or just not fun, it could kill the momentum of the game. Again, this is just speculation. Maybe you only just play as Link. There does seem to be a portion where he is in some sort of cave, which has me excited. He also has something attached to his shield, which could hint towards some customization or augmentation options for weapons. I love the breakable weapon system in the original game, but many didn't. I wonder if they will stick with that system or try to find some middle ground. Maybe you have parts of weapons on you that you can then construct if something breaks, like a hilt and then a blade and maybe something else. Making some sort of weird sword with different powers and abilities sounds like a lot of fun, and it would make battles very dynamic. For some reason, we still don't have a name. My theory is that there is some major gameplay gimmick yet to be revealed that will tie in with the title. I don't think it will be Skies of the Wild or Breath of the Sky or anything like that. However, I can figure out what the new gameplay gimmick would be. I mean, a bunch of sky islands seems big enough, but then why hide the title? Maybe they want to hold it until they get some sort of date, like they did with the original game. But I'm guessing they are hiding some sort of wild gameplay feature that will tie everything together. Release date? This screams big holiday title. Any day in 2022 is fine with me. That's it for Nintendo's big first-party releases, that we know about for now at least. Now I'd like to focus on some third-party games. Sonic. He's back. With Sonic Frontiers, an open-zone Sonic game that seems to be heavily inspired by Breath of the Wild. It has those wide green verdant fields and piano music. That's all you need. I talked a bit about it last episode, but one of the issues with an open-world Sonic game is that Sonic is fast and can cover a huge amount of land very quickly. I'm curious to see how Sonic Team handles this conundrum. I think it will be much more linear than advertised, with maybe an open-world area that you roam around in between main levels. I'm glad Sonic Team is being ambitious, and if this is a big hit, this might be a new path for 3D Sonic. Can't lie though, I wish we got a Sonic Mania 2. That first game was so excellent, and even the DLC, which was a bit unusual on paper, was amazing and recontextualized the game. A Plague Tale Requiem, the sequel to A Plague Tale Innocence, will hit Switch in 2022 via the cloud. The first game came out in 2021 and was also a cloud version. I always say this, but does the Switch user base pay attention to cloud games? I feel like it's a good solution to the hardware problem, but is the audience there? The Kingdom Hearts games came to Switch via the cloud, and I felt like nobody cared. But I guess it's better than nothing, and maybe there is an audience for it. Capcom put out the cloud version of Resident Evil 7 on Switch, but didn't follow through with Village, so maybe that says something. Card Shark from Devolver Digital is a card game with a unique twist. You're a huge cheater. It takes place in 18th century France, and you need to win by any means necessary, whether it's lying or outright cheating. And the team behind it worked on Reigns and Piku Niku. Reigns is a fantastic series with a simply brilliant gameplay gimmick that is easy to understand. Card Shark has a striking art style and a wonderful soundtrack, so this could be the next big indie hit on Switch. Convergence, a League of Legends Stories, is an action platformer that takes place, you guessed it, in the world of League of Legends. Riot has been expanding their number one franchise into a lot of different games across various genres. Ruin King got a lot of praise last year, so it seems to be like these are not just cheap cash grabs. I don't know anything about League of Legends, but these projects are out there to grab people like me. Action platformer? Sure, I'll check it. Oh no, now I've played 3,000 hours of League. Is that what they want? The art style is very anime-like, and it looks very stylish, kind of cyberpunky. There's also another League of Legends universe game, Song of Nunu, from the Rhyme team. It's described as a 3D single-player adventure that takes place in an icy region. Which one will be better? Only time will tell. I do like how experimental these games seem to be. They aren't just sticking to one genre. I'm not sure if a League of Legends story attracts people or simply puts them off, though. Dark Deity, a Fire Emblem-like, is supposed to hit Switch this year. It looks to mimic the classic Fire Emblem GBA games in appearance. Gotta love those sprites. It got solid reviews when it hit PC, so fans of the FE might want to check it out. I recently played Banner of the Maid, another obvious FE clone. That game has some strong points, but it was too straightforward and simplistic. The thing I like about FE is the customization and how I build my strategy around my party loadout. Keep customization in mind, FE clones. It's not just about chess with swords. WayForward isn't just releasing Advance Wars in 2022. They are also going to publish Dawn of the Monsters, a kaiju beat-em-up. It has a very vibrant and colorful art style. It's developed by 13AM Games, which did Runbow, another game that looked great in motion. I feel beat-em-ups are having a comeback with Streets of Rage 4 and River City Girls, but introducing a new IP is a bit harder. I do feel WayForward's name recognition is strong enough to get eyes on this title, though. Speaking of WayForward, River City Girls 2 and River City Girls 0 are set to come out in 2022. River City Girls 2 is the sequel to the first River City Girls, a beat-em-up in the style of the old Kunio-kun games. Zero is actually a port of the Super Famicom Kunio-kun game called Shin-Niketsu Kouha Kunio-tachi no Banka. I bought the Kunio-kun Double Dragon collection recently, and those games still hold up. The Kunio-kun ones, at least. The first game has an eternal spot on my wishlist, so maybe I should just wait and jump into the second one. WayForward is also working on RWBY Aerofell, a Metroidvania that takes place in the RWBY universe. Man, they're busy, aren't they? I'm not saying put 100% of your effort into Advance Wars, but put 100% of your effort into Advance Wars. Digimon Survive from Bandai Namco is described as a, quote, visual novel with strategy survival role-playing elements. What does that mean? This game was actually announced in 2018, so it's been in development for a while. I have never touched the Digimon game, believe it or not. I am a Pokemon guy, though I do love other monster collecting RPGs. I want to try those Cyber Sleuth games, but, you know, time. I am interested to see how they balance out all the different genres into a coherent game. It really seems like they are shoving every type of game genre in here. More survival coming up. Bandai Namco is also releasing Dragon Ball The Breakers. It's an async multiplayer survive. It's Dead by Daylight, but with Dragon Ball characters. I'm not into this genre, but making it more silly and fun instead of the horror theme that these games typically use is a new take that could get a lot of people interested. There are a lot of fun powers and gadgets in Dragon Ball, so if they incorporate them into the game, it should be worth looking at. Getsu Fumaden, Undying Moon from, yes, Konami, is coming to Switch in 2022. This is a remake of the 1987 Famicom game that never hit the States. The original is a hack-and-slash title with a medieval Japanese look, even though apparently it takes place in the future. This remake has rogue light elements, and also throw in a dash of Dark Souls and Castlevania as well. The original title is still constantly referenced in other Konami games, and even has a song in Smash. It has an ukiyo-e aesthetic, which automatically has me interested. It's currently in early access on Steam, and most people seem to like it. Set a game in ancient Japan, or just give me some ninja or samurai weapons, and I will pay attention. Somehow, some way, Switch is also getting Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light, and Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris this year. These are the isometric co-op-focused action-adventure games that came out in the early 2010s. Switch is a great co-op console, so it makes sense, but I felt like nobody has talked about these games in a very long time, especially after Tomb Raider was rebooted. But hey, put all games on Switch. Every game that came out before 2014 should be on Switch somehow. LEGO Star Wars The Skywalker Saga is finally coming out in 2022. It was announced in 2019 and covers episodes 1 through 9. I had quite a bit of fun with the original LEGO Star Wars, and I tried some of the other LEGO games, but its luster kind of wore off. But this seems like a great pickup for kids, and it should have a lot of content considering it covers 9 whole films. Little Devil Inside is an action-adventure title from Neostream Interactive. It's coming to PlayStation first, and then Switch later. This is an impressive-looking title that takes place in a 19th-century-style steampunk setting. It blends survival elements with open-world exploration and general monster fighting. Some of the survival elements we've seen are pretty interesting and remind me a bit of Breath of the Wild. You get water from a cactus and things like that. I really like the look of this game. It has a very simple yet clean graphical style, almost like the characters are little plastic toys. Little Devil Inside originally started on Kickstarter all the way back in 2015. It was planning to hit the Wii U at some point, believe it or not, but it finally looks like it could be coming out sooner than later. There's a nice trailer for it that was released in 2021. I highly recommend everyone check it out. The Lord of the Rings Gollum is an action-adventure game where you play as Gollum. Yes, this is real. There was recently a trailer where it showed the dual personalities of Sméagol and Gollum fighting with each other. This contrast seems to be reflected in the gameplay, with Sméagol being meek and relying on stealth, while Gollum is more aggressive. The concept is pretty weird. I mean, who wants to play as Gollum? But The Lord of the Rings has a lot of material to work with. Marvel's Midnight Suns from Firaxis Games, the team behind XCOM and many others. Originally, it had a March release date, but then it got pushed back to the second half of 2022. Gotta give Kirby some room, I guess. It's a tactical card-based game starring Marvel heroes, but the protagonist is your OC. Although all the actions and attacks are card-based, it still looks like a strategy game in the vein of XCOM. You can interact with the environment to set off chain reactions and so forth. Each character has its own deck, and that sounds great to me. I think y'all will have a lot of fun min-maxing everyone's powers and abilities. There's also a central hub that you can walk around and talk to the other superheroes. It reminds me a bit of the hub of Fire Emblem Three Houses. And yes, anything that vaguely reminds me of Fire Emblem has my attention. There's a good mix of heroes from many Marvel properties, and I really like the focus on the more supernatural elements of the Marvel Universe. I think that allows for more enemy diversity and wilder attacks and battles. I'm really excited for this game, but I'm also a bit worried about the Switch performance. XCOM 2 on Switch didn't run that great according to many, but hopefully Firaxis is more accustomed to the Switch hardware this time around. If you want a more traditional tactics game, here are 3 words that should perk you up. Metal, Slug, Tactics. .emu is bringing the classic action game to the tactics genre, sprites and everything. The game looks amazing visually. It has those beautiful Metal Slug sprites and glorious HD. Not a lot of gameplay has been shown, but there are so many things you could do with a tactics game set in the Metal Slug universe. I mean, you gotta fight those Mars people. In the old Metal Slug games, you had to pick a character, so having them all fighting out together is really appealing. Here's hoping they can translate the SNK classic into a new world. Neon White, from the developer of Donut County, is a card-based first-person action game where you play as an assassin in heaven. You know, that hotel. Literally everything you do seems to be dictated by cards, whether it's attacks or even just movement. The trailer showed a grappling hook card and one that warps you forward. I'm not quite sure if I can wrap my brain around this, but I at least want to try it. Oxenfree 2 Lost Signals is also coming to Switch this year. I actually played Oxenfree for the first time over the summer and quite enjoyed it. It's an adventure game where the main gimmick is tuning a radio. It's heavily story-driven and is effectively creepy without relying on jump scares. The sequel takes place 5 years after the first game and has a new protagonist, so I'm wondering how connected it will be to the first game. Let's stay in Creepyville and talk about Omori. From Omocat, this was the big announcement at the most recent Indie World. It's an Earthbound-inspired RPG, but apparently things take a turn. I don't know much outside of everybody loving it. I guess I should go into this blind, so I'm trying not to read too much into it. I predict this will be a huge hit on Switch and won't leave the top of the eShop charts anytime soon after its release. Another RPG, Sea of Stars, is coming out in late 2022. It's from the developers of The Messenger. This one doesn't look creepy, but who knows? It has lovely 16-bit style sprites, and the combat seems to rely on 2 distinct characters. Yasunori Mitsuda, famed Chrono composer, also has his hands on this game. The art style is phenomenal, and it's a 16-bit JRPG? Say no more. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Shredder's Revenge, is a beat-em-up from .emu and Tribute Games, who developed Mercenary Kings. They are basically making another Turtles game in the style of those old Konami brawlers, and I'm here for it. The art style and music are all on point, and yes, you can throw a foot soldier at the screen. There have been several attempts at making new Turtles games, including the co-op one from Platinum, but those have all underperformed. Might as well go back to the well and update a popular concept. It is using the look of the original animated series, so they are making a big nostalgia play. I feel like many wouldn't be excited if they used a more recent series or came up with their own look. For many, the 80s Turtles are the Turtles. They recently revealed that April is playable, which is an awesome idea. Splinter seems like an obvious confirmation, and Casey Jones? You gotta put him in. Usagi Yojimbo is an out there pick, but not impossible. They might save some of these characters for DLC though. Online co-op was also confirmed, but if you can try, grab some friends for local co-op. I'm going to end talking about unannounced games with everyone's favorite, most anticipated title, Two Point Campus. This is a sequel to Two Point Hospital. People liked that first game, and I would rather hang out in a college than a hospital, so sign me up. No confirmation regarding whether or not Sonic will be here though. Did I miss a game or two? Probably. Sorry. But let's move on to games that aren't announced yet. There have been times where Nintendo had almost nothing announced in January, but obviously 2022 is pretty different. Even though there are quite a few major titles coming out of Nintendo, I'm sure they have some that haven't even been announced yet. Now it's time for some wild speculation. Intelligent Systems. They released at least one game per year. The last year they skipped 1997. Seriously, look it up. They have a 20-plus year streak of releasing at least one game on Nintendo hardware. If you're not already clapping, start applauding Intelligent Systems right now. So it goes without saying that IS is likely working on another game and has it up their sleeve for 2022. We got WarioWare last year, Paper Mario the year before, so I think those two are out. And the Advance Wars remake is being developed by somebody else, so that doesn't count. That leaves Fire Emblem, which did have a game in 2019, but it is a franchise ripe for remakes. They released Echoes in 2017, and it sold fairly well, but a lot of attention was already on the Switch. Another FE remake, possibly of FE4, is pretty likely in my mind. But it will have been 3 years since Three Houses, which had some DLC, but not a lot. So a brand new Fire Emblem game is possible, but a bit less likely. So maybe COVID hit IS hard and they want to focus on a smaller franchise, like Pushmo or Puzzle League. I would love either on Switch. Though I think an FE4 remake is the likeliest, keep an eye out for Intelligent Systems this year for sure. Nintendo has also been on a kick regarding reviving DS titles. They brought back Brain Age, Big Brain Academy, Clubhouse Games. What could possibly be left? Well, one of the best-selling games of all time, Nintendogs. I don't know how Nintendo hasn't put out a new Nintendogs game out on Switch yet. The 3DS titles were nowhere near as popular, but they sold millions of copies. Millions. That's 6 zeros with a number in front of it. Put out a new Nintendogs on Switch, and honestly, I think that would be an easy 5 million seller at least. To be honest, I would likely skip it, but, you know, millions won't, I promise. Okay, here's a curveball for you. Will Game Freak have two games in 2022? They've been working on Arceus, which is a huge departure from your typical Pokemon title, but they are also clearly working on Gen 9. Gen 5 was 2010. Gen 6 was 2013, 3-year gap. Gen 7 was 2016, 3-year gap. Gen 8 was 2019, 3-year gap. So could Gen 9 be this year? It seems very unlikely with Arceus, but who knows? If it's not 2022, is Gen 9 a holiday 2023 title? Would a Switch version of Gen 9 compete with a possible Switch 2 release at the same time? Or will Switch 2 launch in early 2024, similar to how new Pokemon games came out a few months before the new hardware? The sheer existence of Arceus has led to a lot of confusing situations. If there was no Arceus, I think it would be very safe to say that Pokemon Gen 9 is this year. Maybe Game Freak wants to put out Arceus, gather feedback, and then try to utilize some of its gameplay mechanics in Gen 9, which will be a very late Switch title, or maybe an early Switch 2 title. I'm very interested to see where it ends up. Mario. Remember Mario? He will probably pop up in more than one game this year. Another sports title? We got golf and tennis, so it seems too early for that. We also just got a new Mario Party. I think Mario Kart 9 is not needed at all. Odyssey 2? It would be pretty wild for both Odyssey 2 and Breath of the Wild 2 to launch in the same year, But hey, remember 2017? I feel Nintendo has a ton of ideas for an Odyssey 2 that they've held off on. Let's go back to Delfino. And yes, Mario is going to be in a huge movie this holiday, so it makes sense that Nintendo would want to have some game to launch beside it, or at least a few months beforehand. Odyssey 2 makes perfect sense in this scenario. I would like another Mario and Luigi RPG. I know Alpha Dream has been shuttered, but maybe some of the staff came over to Nintendo. If not, I wouldn't mind another studio having a crack at it. One game that has been heavily rumored is a new Donkey Kong title from Nintendo. Not retro, not rare, but one of Nintendo's own internal studios. I have to wonder what their angle with DK would be. Nintendo can do anything, so why would they want to invest their time and money into Donkey Kong? I think it won't be just another Donkey Kong Country game, but some different spin on the formula. Maybe they would do a complete 180 and bring back Donkey Kong 94 too. Donkey Kong 22. It's kind of catchy. Will Metroid Prime 4 be this year? I think unlikely, but a Metroid Prime remake or remaster is always rumored. If you're going to release it, you might as well release it this year before you get Metroid Prime 4 out there. I could sit here all day speculating about more Nintendo games, but we could have a direct announce before the next episode. I'm incredibly excited for Switch in 2022. If even half of the games I talked about are good, it will be a phenomenal year for gaming. Let's all use our power and give all our energy to Nintendo so they can unleash the spirit bomb that is Breath of the Wild 2 in 2022. All right, let's check out some news. News time. I can't lie, it's kind of slim pickings this go around. Turns out companies normally don't announce stuff during Christmas for some reason. But there are some tidbits I want to touch on. Anytime there isn't much news, I can always fall back on an old classic, Japanese hardware and software sales. Week 50 saw Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl on top again with 116K, meaning it's now above 2.1 million physical in Japan. This game is en route to being the best-selling Pokemon remake ever, easily topping Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire, which sit at 14 million. Safe to say, Ilka has hit the jackpot and will likely be handling Pokemon remakes for the foreseeable future. I know a lot of people may be disappointed with this, but if Game Freak wants to be more experimental and ambitious with the main Pokemon games, they would need to direct their attention to that and let another team handle the remakes. I think we are definitely going to get Black and White remakes from Ilka much sooner than later. There won't be a 7-year gap this time around. It's kind of funny to see how close the remakes were to the original games and how that gap is widening. We got the Gen 1 remakes in Gen 3, so 2 gens ahead. Gen 2 remake in Gen 4, again 2 gens ahead. Gen 3 remake in Gen 6, okay, now we're at 3. And the Gen 4 remake is in Gen 8, so 4 ahead. I think it's safe to presume that the Black and White remakes would be after Gen 9, keeping that 4-gen gap. Number 2 spot is Mario Party Superstars, which is now above 500k retail in Japan. Big Brain Academy slides in at 3rd place. That game seems to be doing fairly well and will have some nice legs. I talked about it a few weeks ago, so check that episode out. Like last time, and the 4th time this year, Switch has had a clean 30 for 30 sweep. 30 games, 30 Switch titles. It might be weeks before a PlayStation game hops in there. Hardware sales. Switch is at 176k for the week, down from 263,000 from last year. This has pretty much been the talking point for this week. Has Switch reached the saturation point? Are we past the Switch's growth peak? I think it's safe to say yes. Once you hit the peak, there's nowhere else to go but down. Maybe the Switch set an absurd standard for itself. I mean, hardware sales are still phenomenal, but fewer units is fewer units. Nintendo looks to have an incredibly strong 2022, so they should clean up in software sales, but will this also lead to stronger hardware sales? The OLED is certainly less appealing than a theoretical Switch Pro, so I definitely think that has dampened sales potential. With the chip shortage still in effect, it's hard to predict when a Switch 2 would come out. 2023 still seems pretty soon to me, but it's not out of the question. Back to overall software sales, Bravely Default 2 has passed the 1 million mark worldwide. I feel like this game came out to mild fanfare, but Switch games have legs, and this title managed to hit a million nearly a year after its release. It's easy to forget that games that aren't being talked about week in and week out are still out there raking in the dough. Switch titles especially don't solely rely on that first month of sales, and of course the PC version certainly helped. I'm curious about the future of the franchise. Asano's team is working on triangle strategy now, and I feel the potential in HD2D has still yet to be tapped. I don't think Bravely Default is a franchise that needs yearly entries, but I think another entry in the series is likely in a few years. Jinx, Fila, put them together, what do you get? A very weird collaboration, albeit with some cool merch. Jinx and its evolutions will be featured in a new line of Fila merch starting from January 8th. Shirts, bags, plushies, everything you could ask for. I always wonder how these collaborations start. Does somebody at Fila really like Jinx, or somebody at the Pokemon Company is a huge Fila head? It's always cool to see Jinx get some shine, though. Such a great design and a very useful Pokemon throughout the game. I mean, nearly everyone has a Luxray on their team when they fight Cynthia. Even though Jinx is very cute, it really isn't highlighted that much, but it will reappear in Pokemon Legends Arceus this month. Nidoroid is going to make Among Us figures, which will launch in 2022, and reservations are being taken now. There are three versions, a red one, black one, and a light blue one. They have some fun accessories, like the hand, and you can separate them into halves complete with their bone. I guess that's their spine. Like most of us, I was really into Among Us in 2020, and it has really taken a while for them to get out some Among Us merch out there. Like most of us, I was really into Among Us in 2020, and it has taken quite a while for them to get some Among Us merch out there. I recently came across a lot of it, and they look pretty neat, but I want a figure of my exact loadout. Pink with a sprout. If they sell that, I'll get it. Nintendo Tokyo also has a few new merch items. There's a fun-looking orange Metroid tumbler. Last time I visited the shop, they had a small booth of Metroid items, mostly clear files and shirts, so it's fun to see them get more. There's also a very cool-looking screw attack pin. Also, there are some new Animal Crossing items themed around winter. Like I mentioned in my feature on Nintendo Tokyo, most AC goods are themed around household items. I can't speak for the quality, but they are cute. They're also restocking the reversible Splatoon cushion. One side is a squid, unzip it and turn it inside out, and it's an octopus. This year has a lot of big first-party Nintendo games, so I would definitely be popping in a few times in 2022. That's it for news. Sorry if anything happened these past few days. I'm recording it a bit early due to the holidays. Now let's get into our feature on Pokemon Wonder. This episode's feature is about the Pokemon Wonder attraction at Yomiuri Land. Yomiuri Land is a popular theme park in Inagi, Tokyo. It's about an hour by train from Shinjuku, in one of those areas that make you think, am I still in Tokyo? But yes, you technically are. Pokemon Wonder is a new attraction to the park, as it was added in July 2021. It's hard to explain Pokemon Wonder in just a sentence. It's often described as a nature adventure where you search for quote-unquote real Pokemon. Some also assume it's just a nature walk with some Pokemon that occasionally pop up that you can point at, but really, it's more of an escape game in its structure. It blends riddle solving with exploring nature, and a bit of safari too. The goal is to find Pokemon hidden in natural environments. There are two courses, a bamboo forest course and a stone wall course. I went on the bamboo forest course. I mean, don't you want to see a bamboo forest instead of a stone wall? I feel like I see stone walls every day. Each course has three sections. Both share the first section, but then it splits off into two different areas, with each course having three total areas. Each area has hidden Pokemon, and with your trusty map filled with hints and armed with a camera, you have to find as many Pokemon as you can within the time limit. At the end, you get a score based on how many Pokemon you found and are given a badge for your hard work. Like escape rooms, you have a time limit and you have to do some riddle and puzzle solving to achieve your goal and find those Pokemon. However, Pokemon Wonder largely takes place outside, so it definitely feels less limited in scope as you explore rather large areas. It also relies more on observational skills, as you at least know that you're looking for Pokemon, so even if you don't solve the riddle, you might happen to come across it if you're eagle-eyed enough. Let's start at the beginning to get a better feel of what to expect. You start off at the research lobby, which is a small building that looks like a real research outpost. You could plop this building into any Pokemon game, and it would look authentic. Plus, the big radar definitely adds that extra something. There's a big sign with a cute Pikachu peeking out, clearly a must-have photo spot. A lot of people like to bring their own Pokemon plushies and line them up next to Pikachu. It's always interesting to see what Pokemon some people are really into. Oh, I guess you're a hardcore Steelix fan, who knew? There's also some Pokemon-branded vending machines and a much-needed locker for your bags. The staff are wearing some hiking-appropriate gear. They definitely look like NPCs you would actually find in Pokemon. And one of the strengths of this attraction is how well they capture the feel of suddenly being thrown into the world of Pokemon. The games are all about the flow of exploring nature and then enjoying the activities in a bustling city. And Pokemon Wonder nails that first part. Once you enter, the staff gives you a digital camera and a pouch to keep your map and any drinks you might have. You then take a seat for your mission briefing. The inside of the research lobby is really awesome. There's this huge blackboard with scribblings about Pokemon in a fake language. It looks like Katakana's weird cousin. I guess there's no defined Pokemon language, unless the unknowns count. There are also these huge banners with Pokemon Wonder's logo, a Pokeball slash compass combo, and a big screen where they play a debriefing video. Oh, and every seat comes with a clipboard describing the rules. You might be thinking, why do they give you a digital camera? Everyone has a camera on them at all times. There are actually multiple reasons why they give you a camera to use, some for the game to function correctly, and also for some money-grabbing purposes. You are supposed to use the camera to take photos of the Pokemon. It does give the activity a bit more authentic nature researcher type of feel. I don't know if researchers pull out their phone to take photos of what they're studying, though maybe they do. Also, at the end where you log which Pokemon you saw, you hand in your camera for them to check. I guess this is to prevent people from outright lying, though to be honest, I'm not sure how thoroughly they check these photos. I assume just mostly the honor system. Lastly, if you want the photos you took with the digital camera, you gotta pay 2,200 yen, or about $20. Now, they do allow you to take photos with your smartphone camera, but they say it doesn't count towards your score and thus affects your prize. I also think they want to discourage smartphone camera use because they are worried about spoilers getting out. They outright ask you not to post photos of the Pokemon, the map, or the areas on social media. At first, I thought this was a very typical aversion to social media that many Japanese companies have, but after experiencing it, I completely get it. A major part of the activity is exploring and solving riddles, so a lot of the fun is taken out of it if you know everything beforehand. And like I mentioned before, you can purchase the pictures you took with the digital camera for $20. Did I do it? Of course. Of course I did. How could I not? Ironically, they just give you the SD card, which is a bit cumbersome to use these days, since not many computers even have SD card slots. Can't you just airdrop them to my phone? So yes, I could technically unleash a flurry of photos on my Instagram, but honestly, I feel like it would hurt the experience for others. Even when it comes to explaining specific scenarios, I kind of have to tiptoe around a lot of solutions. So I might spoil some things, but I do think there's value in not blowing the lid off this and letting people discover it for themselves. After you're briefed, you're led to the first area, Wonder Field. Both routes start here regardless. It's a huge open field, but it changes based on the season. In summer, it looks like a verdant grassland, but if it rains, it suddenly turns into a gigantic mud hole. I guess this is a good segue into what you should be wearing during this thing. I noticed the official account tweeted out a photo of recommended clothing, which included rainwear and gloves. I thought, are you really that deep into nature where you need hiking gear? And yes, you really are. Wear sneakers at least. And if it rains, there is little protecting you. They do give you plastic bags to put over your shoes, which I think you definitely need if it rains. Fortunately, they do provide gloves. Considering how you need to dig through the mud and touch a lot of things, they really are a must-have. The weather was great when I went, clear blue skies and all that, but it did rain like crazy the night before. So Wonderfield was more like Wonder Swamp. But honestly, I thought this added to the atmosphere. You really are trouncing through the mud, trying to get to the next point of interest. There are times where you have to dig through the dirt to uncover something. It's very authentic and tactile. Wonderfield has 15 Pokemon, and you've got a 13-minute time limit. Now, get this in your head now. You aren't going to find all the Pokemon. The point isn't to find them all, but to find as many as you can. My course had 36 Pokemon, and I found 17. So less than half. So every time you actually do find one, you feel a great sense of accomplishment. My group only had 2 people, so I suppose it would be easier if you had more. You definitely need one person to man the map and another one to actually take photos. The map has clues on the back to help you find the Pokemon. Some are easy, some have a sketch of the Pokemon you're looking for, but others are more vague, even if you kind of know the general area where to look. Wonderfield is sort of laid out into sections with points of interest. Like there's one patch with cotton. Yeah, I think a Pokemon is in there. There's also a pile of rocks, an archaeology tent, a small pond, and so on. The way you interact with each area is pretty unique. In the pond, you have to use a net to fish out the Pokemon. Other areas have you swipe away dirt with brushes or dig through rocks. A cool one was a section where I noticed footprints, and then I followed the footprints to the Pokemon. The puzzles were designed by Riddler, a company in Japan that is involved with a lot of escape room games and puzzle-themed exhibits. Pokemon Wonder definitely doesn't feel like your typical theme park attraction, so you can tell there was a lot of care and expertise put into crafting this experience. How the Pokemon are represented can vary. Sometimes it's an actual model of the Pokemon, like Diglett looks like a real Diglett sticking out of the ground. Who knew they were fuzzy? Others are represented in more creative ways. One is sort of made out of hay, others are just images displayed in a creative way. I can't get into a lot of details, but I do feel the Pokemon all really look fantastic. They created some very fun-looking props that I honestly wouldn't mind owning. The first section is probably the easiest, but there is a lot of ground to cover, especially in the mud. Once the time limit is up, you return to a staff member and they give you a new map for the next area. You have to walk a bit between the sections that don't have any Pokemon, so you can just enjoy a relaxing walk in nature. The other group at Wonderfield went on the Stonewall course, so for the rest of the Bamboo Forest course, it was only my group, which was pretty excellent. I didn't have to worry about other groups spoiling things or blocking me. The next area is kind of hard to translate from Japanese. It's kind of like Ancestor's Study. Basically, it's just an old, dilapidated house where some researcher used to live, surrounded by trees. This area is much, much smaller and more dense than the wide-open Wonder Field. You explore the interior of a small hut and the surrounding area. This time, you are limited to 10 minutes. The hut has a bit more of your typical escape room activities, like opening up cabinets and fiddling with weird oddities. It can be a bit difficult to divide your time between the inside and outside, and the Pokemon areas are less segmented and apparent than they were in Wonder Field. I really love the look of the house, and there are a lot of cool items hidden in the cabinets. Although this isn't one of the Pokemon you can find, there are these spirit tombstones hidden in the cabinets, which is a really cool touch for those who notice it. I will give you a hint. Use the flashlight. It's smart to diversify the areas in such a drastic way. The first area is huge and open. The second one is much smaller and compact. The final area returns to a more open space, but it does feel more dense since it takes place in a beautiful bamboo forest. Again, you have 10 minutes. There are dozens of bamboo stalks shooting out of the ground, pine cones scattered about, tree stumps, bamboo sprouts. It's easily the most visually engaging area. This might be the hardest area as well, since there is so much visual stimulation, yet everything kind of looks the same, so it's hard to see any points of interest that stick out. Okay, something's gotta be in one of these fallen bamboo stalks, right? Honestly, for the first 5 minutes, we didn't find anything, but eventually it all kind of came together and we found a few of them. There is an incredible one that perfectly uses bamboo to its advantage. All the way until the end, Pokemon Wonder keeps introducing new tricks and forces you to think about puzzles with out-of-the-box solutions. And hey, anytime standing in the middle of a bamboo forest is time well spent. I will give you another hint, though. In the other areas, the staff pretty much just stands in their designated area. However, this time the staff member kept following us. I thought it was a bit weird and overprotective, but let me tell you, there is a reason. Once you're finished, you then report your findings to the research center at the end of the course. Finally, you have a chance to sit down and wipe the mud off your gloves. You're given a sheet with all the Pokemon on it, and you circle the ones you found. I was shocked to realize how many Pokemon I never saw. Missing a few I could see, but most of them? It's pretty incredible how well some of these are hidden. Even in retrospect, knowing what Pokemon are in the course, I'm still racking my brain trying to figure out where they were. When you turn in your sheet, you also hand in your camera. Like I said before, I'm not sure if they actually thoroughly check each photo. As long as you don't say, I found all of them, they won't bring it up. While you're waiting, they serve you some tea and let you dig through some photos that other people took. Here is a great opportunity to actually see some of the Pokemon you missed. But even from the photograph, it's hard to ascertain where to actually find them. The ending has you watch another video from the professor, and maybe something else. It's pretty impressive, I'll tell you that. After that, you need to hike back all the way to the lobby at the start, where you turn in your gear. You're rewarded with a nice version of the area map, including sketches of all the Pokemon on it, a pouch of professional-looking photographs of the Pokemon you found, and a badge. The Bamboo Forest course has the Leaf badge, but it seems like the Stone Wall course has a Mountain badge. You can then explore the rest of the theme park with your badge proudly displayed. Pokemon Wonder is an amazing experience for Pokemon fans. Even those who don't know anything about Pokemon will still enjoy it because discovering a creature in its natural habitat, hidden in plain sight, is a fantastic feeling. From the aesthetic to the activities, it feels like you are transplanted into the Pokemon game. The course is so well designed and the natural environments are incredibly beautiful. If you are lucky enough to do this on a clear day, you will be enthralled from the start. I still think it would be very fun and atmospheric to do it on a rainy day, but yeah, you want that blue sky. I cannot recommend this highly enough to Pokemon fans. I think maybe you can do it solo, but the more the merrier. At least two would be fine. From start to finish, it takes about 90 minutes, but it does feel longer since you are really engaged and doing stuff at every moment. I must comment that there is currently no English support. The maps and instructions are all in Japanese, so some might have to rely solely on their eyesight to find the hidden monsters. Now, how do you actually get in? Although it's an attraction at the park, it's not something that you can just walk in and do anytime. You need a reservation beforehand. Since it's been getting so crowded recently, the reservation time is incredibly limited. They open up a block of dates about a month ahead of time, and those things go by quickly. I went on Christmas Day, and I had to reserve around Thanksgiving. And I only got in because they announced the opening for the next batch of tickets beforehand, so once purchasing went live, I immediately picked my date and time. Even then, I got a couple of errors during the registration process and noticed some periods were selling out. Within an hour, all times were completely filled. So at least for now, you really have to know beforehand when tickets go on sale and then immediately buy them. I recommend following the official Japanese Pokemon account on Twitter, Yomiuri Land's account, and I think there maybe is a specific one for Pokemon Wonder. They would typically announce ticket dates a few weeks before they go live, so carve out your schedule accordingly. These date blocks are about a month in advance, so if you buy a ticket in January, it will likely be for a February or March date. It's likely always going to be this way since only a few people can explore at a time, though they might extend the slots during the summer since it gets dark later. If you want to go, you really need to plan out at least a month or two in advance. You can make a reservation on AsoView, which is a popular website to purchase event tickets. There isn't any additional fee for Pokemon Wonder. Your ticket comes with the day pass to Yomiuri Land, so you can freely access all parts of the park. Honestly, the rest of Yomiuri Land doesn't really compare to Disney or Universal Studios. It's a park built in the 60s and everything that entails. Some rides have collaborations with Japanese companies, which is pretty interesting. There's a ride from Nissin, the instant noodle company, and Rippopitan, a medical energy drink company. I mean, you won't see those at Disney. But Pokemon Wonder is easily the highlight. But if you do go during the holidays, the Christmas lights are also really fantastic. I will definitely return to do the Stonewall course at a later date. Since you're outside so much, I think spring or fall would be the perfect time to experience Pokemon Wonder. But make sure you get your reservation in. Alright, time for our Japanese phrase of the week. This week's phrase is bakushi. Bakushi. It literally means bomb death. This refers to some catastrophic blunder or failure. I suppose it's somewhat similar to bomb in the English sense. Like, if something sells poorly, we say it bombed. However, in the context of games, this specifically refers to an individual failure. For example, if somebody spends a lot of money on a gacha game to get the pool they want, yet they don't get it, well, you spent a lot of money for no reason, and are empty-handed. And empty-walleted. That is bakushi. I'm not really into gacha, so I have avoided bakushi until now. But I suppose you could still apply it to time as well, like you're grinding to get a specific item drop and never do. Once again, bakushi. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. This episode's tweet is from Nindo_snail. Nindo is a clay sculpture artist who makes fantastical works. Yes, this is the second time I featured a clay artist in the Japanese tweet of the week, and I doubt it will be the last. The tweet that caught my eye was an incredible rendition of Brewster's Cafe, The Roost, as it looks in New Horizons. The sculpture can almost fit into your hand and is meticulously detailed. If Nintendo sold something like this, it would be hard to pass up on. The artist has a lot of other amazing Nintendo-inspired clay art on this Twitter page, including a dual-wielding Piplup and a cool terrarium filled with bug-type Pokemon. As always, the tweet will be in the description. Let's look at a bit of reader mail. John asks, is Book Off any good? What's the best Book Off in Tokyo? Book Off is a used goods chain that is quite prominent in Tokyo. They mostly sell books and CDs, but have quite a big game section too. You can easily stumble across Super Famicom or PS1 games here. As for is it any good? Yes, definitely. I've bought a lot of games from Book Off at fantastic prices. Since the inventory is a bit more random and Book Off doesn't butter their bread solely with retro games, the prices are fairly affordable. I've never seen a game over $100 here. A game at both Book Off and Super Potato, which I covered last week, will almost certainly be cheaper at Book Off. But of course, the inventory can be anything. Maybe they have 30 N64 games. Maybe they have zero. Maybe they only have 4 box copies of Yakuman for Famicom. If you're looking for a specific game, retro game stores are an obvious choice, but if you aren't picky or just want to see what they have, Book Off is an excellent source for retro games. The best Book Off? That's hard to say. I mean, they are all kind of the same, just different sizes. I'm trying to think of which ones have a notable gaming section. The Shinjuku West Exit Book Off is pretty solid, as is the one in Ueno. There's also a big Book Off at Ikebukuro Sunshine City. Though since these Book Offs are in touristy areas, the price is a bit more jacked up than usual. The best Book Offs are the ones that are hidden in small neighborhoods or off the beaten path. But if you're a tourist in Tokyo, just sticking with the bigger shops next to the station is good enough. I think the Shinjuku and Ueno Book Offs are pretty solid, so I'll go with those two. In the future, I will definitely have a feature all about Book Off and its cousin, Hard Off, so stay tuned. Well, that was quite the episode. Thank you as always for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. I also have a YouTube channel and I am on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. So follow me there by searching for Tokyo Game Life. Also, if you want to send in reader mail, contact me at tokyogamelife@gmail.com. Also, check out my site, tokyogamelife.com, for pictures of Pokemon Wonder and other things. No spoilers, but next episode, greatest episode ever. Currently, this is my greatest episode ever, but it will certainly be topped next time. It'll be out Sunday, January 16th. Get hyped and see you next time. Mata ne!